So welcome, everybody. Welcome back to Healthier Vibrations. I'm Christy Smurl, and today we are having a guest speaker for a program. His name is Mr. Mark Stavish. So thank you very much, Mark, for coming on and talking to us today and presenting us with this information that I believe everybody should or could benefit from receiving.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Thank you again. So before we start on our subject today, the subject of today is egregores, self-realization, and ritual purification. Before we go into that, I want to formally introduce you to the listeners who may have not been exposed to you before. So Mr. Mark Stavish is the director of the Institute of Hermetic Studies, a lifelong student and scholar of esotericism. He has over 35 years of experience in comparative religion, philosophy, psychology, mysticism, with an emphasis on traditional Western esotericism. Mr. Stavish has published many books and is one of the leading authorities in Hermeticism today. He's also served as the Director of Research for Occult Research and Applications Project of the Philosophers of Nature, founded by Jean Dubuis in France. Mr. Stavish has 20 years or more as a leading resource for practical information on mineral and plant alchemy, which I would like to dig my hands into a little bit deeper of those studies you've done. And he is also a graduate of King's College with a degree in theology and communications, as well as a master's degree in counseling, emphasizing psychospiritual modalities, psychosynthesis from Rhode Island College. I'm really excited to have Mr. Mark Stavish on today. He's been a guest on Coast to Coast AM, Just Energy Radio, the Animal Planet History Channel, and he's been a consultant for documentaries and literature regarding spiritual literature as well. And Mark, I also understand you're doing a prison education project as well, right?
Well, we do an outreach, and that kind of fell into our lap probably 15 years ago, and we weren't really able to do much with it. Some folks decided that it would be very nice of them to put our mailing address on some neo-pagan prison outreach program. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there was not a lot of prison outreach in terms of new and emerging religions and alternative religions. Unfortunately, though, what they failed to do is ask us first if we could put our name on that list. And so we are continually getting these requests for information, and we would try to fulfill them as best we could. But at that time, we are finding out the hard way, despite my profession and my experience in social services, that you couldn't send CDs, you couldn't send unbound matter, you couldn't send spiral bound, you had to send bound books, and there's a whole process to go through. So that fell by the wayside until a few years ago when we started getting some funding. And that just made that, along with our own, having our own books, our own program of study in place, that made all the difference in the world. Because then when men who were incarcerated would contact us, we would have something that we could not only send them, but we could afford to send them. And we had some folks who were willing to put some money behind the project as well. So that was really very helpful. So we've enjoyed that, and it's nice. And it comes in waves, you know, it comes and goes. So I have a huge fan base among the Northern California prison system. And if they're listening, thanks, guys.
That's fantastic. I've definitely been a fan of your printed work for quite some time. I remember 2 years ago or so, I was on a really long flight to India. And on my flight there and back, I just completely devoured three books in particular that are going to apply to the discussion today. The first was Egregores, the Occult Entities That Watch Over Human Destiny. The second that I loved was The Path of Alchemy, the Energetic Healing in the World of Natural Magic. And then the third that really moved me and brought together a lot of information for me was Ritual Purification, Exorcism, and Defensive Magic. So I personally thank you for that knowledge and education to make it so readily accessible.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So one thing I wanted to ask first today is, you know, for people who are listening, could you tell me a little bit or tell us a little bit about when and why and how you've blazed this deep path in the esoteric and spiritual path?
Well, you know, I grew up around it, so that was, it's nothing new to me. My family had some background in European folk magic going back to, well, then it was Eastern Germany, now it's Western Poland. That whole area was ripe with all sorts of heretical doctrines for 300 or 400 years. So, you know, when they came over, they brought that with them, and my great uncle, who I grew up around, was involved with all of the major esoteric movements of the 20th century. And, you know, myself, it was very easy for me to get involved. In terms of trailblazing, I don't know if I've done that as much as I've tried to bring together a understanding of the importance of both traditional practices and the psychotherapeutic emphasis in modern practices. These tend to be at odds with one another, and they need not be, and in fact, they shouldn't be. You know, esotericism is not an excuse for psychotherapy. That needs to be clearly understood. Your guru is not your therapist. In fact, they're there to provoke you, not to make you feel good. So, when people often get involved in occult practices, they wonder why their lives go to crap rather than getting better. And that's because, you know, when we're talking about energy, as much as I hate that phrase, the reality is when you bring more energy into the system, you're going to disrupt it, because that's essentially what you want to do. Even if it's just something like saying, you know, I want to focus my energies and visualize myself getting straight A's this semester. You know, that means some things stay and some things go. Okay, there's going to be disruption to the system, because if you were happy the way things were, you wouldn't be seeking to change. So one has to be prepared for that, and all that goes on with that. And at the same time, you know, a lot of the things that are being passed off as modern spiritual practices, they are useful, but at the same time, we need to also look at what has traditionally been done as well to get an understanding. You can't have traditional experiences without traditional practices. And while we often like to think of a lot of these teachers, I would say everyone wants to study magic in a castle until it's January and they're in one. Okay. And I remember a group I ran that was quite funny, because, you know, in January, in that wonderful fourth floor clock tower, it's cold. Okay. That's just all there is to it. So we have to begin to work with these very dynamic extremes and learn how to bring them together within ourselves. And I think if you say trailblazing, maybe egregores might be what you're hinting at. Because up until its publication, I believe it really was maybe not the only book on the subject, but I think the only book in English, and there may only have been one or two in French. And
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it was not a well-known term. My wife said something yesterday, how she was on some call or something and someone used the term, and she wasn't sure if they used the term properly or not. And it just struck her, and I said, well, tell them that your husband is the one who has brought that term into the zeitgeist. That won't happen, but you know.
The first time I heard the term, I thought, what on earth is that? And as soon as I got a hold of the book, it really changed a lot of things in my life. So, you know, while we're on that subject, you know, can you discuss with the listeners, you know, what is an egregore and why is it important to recognize these powerful forces or even entities that really shape our lives?
Yep. Well, and for the purists out there, we are mispronouncing the word. It is one of those potato-potato situations, but since it is Greek, everyone gets an excuse at pronouncing it poorly. And so we're just going to go with the Anglified, the Americanized pronunciation, egregore, okay? And it is back to what you said, everyone who's read the book has said to me that it's life-changing. And that's really nice to know, because that's what it was meant to do. And the reason it is life-changing is because it suddenly puts things in perspective. It gives you a word, a term, an idea that you can say, okay, I get it. That's what's happening. That's what's going on. And this goes back to what I said earlier about traditional teachings. Traditional teachings say that, you know, the gods always had two names, demons have two names, whatever. You have to know the name of the thing in order to control it. And that's true in anything. If we don't have a word to describe a situation or a condition, we either need to create one, be comfortable with our ambiguity, or continue to be annoyed by the fact that we don't have a term that really describes what's happening. So having a word that says, this is what is going on, is very important for people right now, right at this time. Because an egregore is a thought form, but it is a collective thought form. And it is a really a social control mechanism, to steal that phrase from Jacques Vallée with regards to his investigation of UFOs and related phenomena, paranormal phenomena. And we say social control mechanism because it has a limitation function. It limits your understanding of things. And that's okay. Because if you go to the university and you want to be an electrical engineer, there's only so many classes and literature that you could take and graduate with a degree in engineering. And the reverse is true. If you want to go to the university and graduate with a degree in visual arts, there's only so many classes in mathematics or history or something else that you're going to be able to take and graduate with that degree in fine arts. So we have to understand limitation in of itself is neither here nor there. It's just the nature of our existence. It's the nature of life itself. Remember Saturn. Okay, Saturn is all about limitation, and it's, you know, they call it queen of the heavens, okay, because it decides everything, what we can and cannot do within a given framework. So a social control mechanism is that framework. Well, look at anything you belong to, primarily religion or philosophy is what, or politics is what this book is trying to awaken people to. You have a philosophical view, which means this is in and that is out. So we increasingly seeing people focusing only what is within their framework and not even paying any attention to what's outside of it. Not just accepting that it's out there and maybe looking at it and trying it on. I mean, they're not even looking at the buffet of ideas anymore. You know, they're just walking in and they're sitting themselves down in front of the bowl of Jell-O or whatever, and that's it. That's their entire a meal, if you will, spiritually or politically or what have you thinking. So think of that. It's the social control mechanism that has us down here at one end on terra firma, the people. And then at the other end, well, that's the big question, isn't it? What's at the other end? Well, traditionally, it could be gods. It could be angels. It could be archangels. It could be a whole host of deities and the entire hierarchy in between. Because how often haven't you sat down at your sangha and you've done your prayers to all the masters of the lineage? Well, that's your egregore. You've done all the prayers to the bodhisattvas and all the masters of the line. That's your egregore. The saints of the church, the 36 holy men of Kabbalah. All of those in some way are expressions of an egregore. In the modern sense, we would just say it's a collective mindset. It's the collective unconscious that Jung speaks about. So when you go to work and they talk about corporate culture, that would be an egregore. I know I've taken a lot of time, but that's it in a nutshell.
No, that's perfect. Absolutely perfect introduction as well. You know, because when I read the book, Egregores, I realized that there are protective egregores, productive egregores, and that some are manipulative and harmful. And those are the ones that sometimes we don't realize are like insidious systems of control. And, you know, when we talk about spiritual development or self-actualization or, you know, enlightenment, we want to purify ourselves from these, or at least become aware of them to counterbalance them as effectively as possible. You know, when I was reading the book on that you wrote, you know, I became also aware of things like the the effect of ancestry and how that is even transmitted down generation after generation, and how we need to work on all these different factors to purify ourselves. So could you talk a little bit about this concept of egregores, specifically in ancestry, but then we'll move on to some other different types. Because I had never conceived the thought of an egregore in ancestry.
Well, that's probably one of the oldest ones, because that's the ones we see most traditionally. And this is the problem of the modern era, particularly the modern West, which tends to see things as it, you know, we see the mutation of the human potential movement in the 60s and 70s into the New Age movement, into the current movement, whatever that is, complete with this political doctrines. And each time it morphs, it keeps trying to separate itself from the past. Not include the past, but separate. And that is a uniquely modern notion, that we can separate ourselves from the past. And in fact, that with that, it means that we see the postmodern notion that things are interchangeable, that people are interchangeable. And we see this notion, well, people are all equal. And we say, no, they're not. Because equal is a mathematical term. 1 + 1 = 2, whatever. These things are the same on either side of the equal sign. People are not interchangeable. And, you do not want me being your open heart surgeon any more than you want me being, you know, the mechanic on your Mercedes, or your motorbike for that most. Bicycle, maybe, that's about it. Okay. You know, and some minor other automotive stuff. But that's about the end of it, because I am not interchangeable with the people who have those skills. So we make errors in a lot of these notions and these ideas because they sound good, but we don't actually think about what they mean in practice. So when we look at family lines, we often hear the phrase unto the seventh generation. And the reason being is, if you simply do the math in terms of family tree, you would see that it onto the eighth generation it takes to make a complete genetic change in that line. You just do the math, you know, how it subdivides on your tree. And up until recently, they used to do those in high school. You would do your family tree and, you know, mom and dad and grandpa, and you'd maybe do some genetic analysis on that and see how things, the basics work, okay? So you carry with you the memories, in a sense, of these people, which is those genes, which are active and inactive. And we can call that, in a sense, a karma, cause and effect. Karma is the best way to look at it, is habit patterns or memories, you know, causes and effect. So we have an understanding of this in family therapy, and we have some understanding of this in terms of lineage, but, you know, your family is your first lineage. You know, your mother is your first guru. Your guru is your second guru, and God is your third guru. So we have to look at that line and how that comes down to us and our participation in that, because that is how we are here. That's how we are in this world. Now, some people understand that there can be a certain manipulation of these lines, and hence we have the notion, at least in some schools of Tibetan Buddhism, of the tolku, the reincarnated lama. And these tolkus are, there is a process whereby one may attempt to take the bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is described as compassion, which is a terrible word because it doesn't mean compassion. A better way of describing it would be the awakened, courageous heart when we think of it. However, in this term, bodhicitta means the essences, the red and white essence, the male and female energies, the sexual fluids and the blood that are purified through inner tantric work that are then combined to create a genetic offspring, which will be a good vehicle for the incarnation of this llama. We see some of these ideas in Western sexual magic. We have some vague references to it, and I think Crowley's work Moonchild, although I haven't looked at that in decades. So this idea that you can have an impact on your genetic line through spiritual practices, through these yogic and tantric and alchemical practices, is very clear in Indian, Chinese, and Tibetan practices and others as well. And it does exist to some degree in alchemy and Kabbalah, although it's much more hushed up there, very quiet about it. So you see these families that can then project into the future, and they plan their future lines just as you would plan your daily schedule. Okay. To some degree, we see that in the West. And I think a interesting place to start, although it would be the somewhat disturbing book by Peter Mark Adams, The Game of Saturn, in which he looks at this notion within the framework of, I believe, early Renaissance Italian magic, as it was coming in from the collapsing Byzantine Empire at that time, as Byzantine Christianity was collapsing. And this was moving into Northern Italy, and how these ideas were taken up by the Italian, certain Italian noble families, who were the ones who financed what we call the Renaissance, which was the rebirth of ancient learning, which was not, you know, art and pictures. It was ancient philosophy, primarily focusing on the Greco-Egyptian beliefs. So it was magic. That's what they were concerned with. And probably Eros and Magic in the Renaissance by Ioannis Coulianos is a somewhat difficult but well worth a book worth reading on that subject. But as you see in Adam's book, he talks about how these families held these magical beliefs and ideas of, again, generation after generation, having a certain allegiance to maybe this deity or that deity in order to preserve their power. I was watching a video maybe a month ago or so on YouTube regarding Taoism, and a friend of mine who's quite experienced in classical Taoism from that period with an impeccable degree, he said, "Oh, this guy's lying." Now, they always lie. He goes, because, you know, first of all, the family wouldn't be around that long if they didn't continue to practice this. So you look at these family lines and, you know, they're there. Now that's an established line. We see a minor degree of that to some degree in maybe what we think of as nobility or famous family lines like the Kennedys. I mean, for all that has happened, who would want to be a Kennedy? I mean, the family's cursed, you know? But you see minor family lines like around here where I live that have been around since the revolutionary period and have managed to do quite well for themselves. And then you see even lesser known lines all the way down to your family line and my family line and anyone else's. The more planning and precision that goes into it, the greater the potentiality for success. The less planning and precision that goes into it, then you get what you get. It's no different spiritually than it is genetically, because they're really one and the same. And that's a tricky subject.
Definitely. Definitely. Now, for somebody who's coming to the concept of egregore, and it's maybe a newer subject for them, how would you advise somebody or recommend somebody to understand, other than sitting down and reading the book, which is priceless, how forces within, let's say, mass media, politics and literature affect them unknowingly?
Yeah, that's really fun because it's simple. All you have to do is look at what you keep paying attention to all the time. Where the mind goes, the prana flows. What is using, you know, I'm assuming most of your listeners are familiar with yoga. So where is the Shakti going? Where's your attention?
Because they need to realize that where their prana is flowing, they're feeding the egregore. Right.
Exactly.
They're giving it more power, even if it's something that they dislike. Let's take, for instance, somebody who is constantly looking at social media and angry about the status of how things are. And that consumes a good portion of their life. I've come to believe that that is actually them directing their flow of attention, their prana, their shakti. They are making that force stronger, even though they feel they're resisting it, they're feeding it. Would that be a correct statement?
Sure. And, you know, when we think of resistance, if we're talking about a living entity, a living organism, as opposed to, say, the wall or the floor, you know, if I want to get stronger, I exercise. And to have exercise, I need resistance. So, you know, push-ups are wonderful because the floor doesn't go anywhere. So what happens? The more resistance I have, the stronger I get. So the more you resist this thing, because it's a living organism, in many respects, the stronger it gets, because you're resisting. You're not providing an alternative. Yeah, I posted something the other day. It was half humor and half serious. And it was regarding Amazon's changing its logo because someone said the tape looked like a Hitler's mustache. And they've changed it now. And I posted a picture of Adolf Hitler saying, thank you very much to everyone for all this attention over the decades and keeping, you know, me alive with all this constant attention. And there's a great deal of truth to that, a tremendous amount. I mean, people think of, and again, people think of that in very simplistic terms, in terms of Nazism or Hitler or something very simple, not in terms of what is the real essence of those philosophical views. That's what keeps getting fed, because the form changes, but it's the essence that we're talking about here. And we see that in a lot of different ways. We change our form every 7 years, right? Some even sooner than that. But, you know, what is the essence? So when you constantly pay attention to things, you're constantly feeding it. That's simple. So, you know, so you look at where your attention is going and ask yourself, do I want my attention to go there? Am I choosing to put my attention there? Or is it just like a train wreck and I can't look away? I'm powerless, or I feel powerless to do it. And what benefit do I get from this? You know, there really is a war on spirituality. There always has been, but we see a change. And the current one is quite fascinating because it comes from the very people who 20 years ago were advocating it. Now they're all against it because they've got no real moral compass. It's just a fad. So now everything is about narcissism. Everything makes you a narcissist. Well, to some degree, this is true. However, this is part of the process of working through spirituality. You have to deal with these things. You need competent teachers. You don't get competent teachers from 200-hour, you know, mindfulness teacher training courses. That doesn't happen. But what this means is, if we're going to not think about ourselves, if every time I think about myself, someone says you're being narcissistic, you have to constantly put your attention outside yourself, okay? And this is where we see that notion of bodhicitta in Tibetan Buddhism get woefully misconstrued. We see the notion of compassion get woefully misconstrued, where your good intentions are used against you. See, that's a manipulation. Your good intentions are used against you. I have to ask myself when I get involved in a group, what's in this for me? And I need a clear answer. Otherwise, I don't know why I'm there. And then someone gets to tell me why I'm there. Someone else gets to decide what my payoff is. And that may not, that's probably not going to be in my best interest. Not may not, but most likely won't be. So it is not narcissistic for you to ask, is it in my best interest to be focusing my attention here? what is in this for me? What do I get out of this?
Absolutely. And I wanted to move back along that same line to when people get involved with things or they're constantly placing their attention, their habits, their actions on things, and they don't know why, and they can't stop, that is there a form of, is there an egregore possibly in place? Because I hear some people say, like, I don't know why I do it. I just can't stop doing it. And I often wonder, is there a degree of, let's say, telepathic psychic manipulation occurring? Or is it just, you know, within the psyche? Has it been built into them? And how that would relate to egregores in particular?
I think unless you're actively involved in a group, the telepathic contact is probably nominal, if non-existent, but nominal. It's a radiance phenomena rather than a directed phenomena. I think what's really happening is just habit. Remember, karma is a force of habit, the force of energy. You've put all your energy into this habit. You've gone from a conscious decision to an unconscious decision, and now is a habitual pattern. And until you remove that pattern with something new, with something, and it just has to be new. Doesn't necessarily have to be a choice. People often change their habits from one thing to another. Okay? We see that in addiction all the time. You go from one drug of choice to another. So it's about awareness. Why am I thinking this thought? Why am I undertaking this action? Why am I saying these words? Remember, thought, word, and deed, body, speech, and mind. Yeah. And how is this beneficial to me? And if it's not, I need to stop it and replace it with something that is. But all of this takes conscious effort.
Very true. A lot of people are just along for a messy ride, and other people are really working on that process of becoming their best form, and not in a narcissistic way.
Well, we are bombarded by sensory input. And it's really important that you disconnect as much as possible from all of this sensory input, because this sensory stimulation constantly pulls you externally. And as we get overwhelmed with that, a sense of inertia builds up. And that inertia then causes us to shut down in order to process that energy. So this notion of sleep, forgetfulness, and death, you know, these are the three enemies we have to overcome. Well, how can you overcome sleep, forgetfulness, and death if you're so exhausted? You collapse, you sleep, you forget. And this is why lucid dreaming is so important, because lucid dreaming means there is a awareness taking place of myself within my own mind. And we are beginning to overcome the inertia of certain, I think what is the word, tamasic energies, yeah. Now, these heavy energies, you're overcoming them. And that happens in the mental state. So as you overcome them, and the light shines in the lucid dreaming state. That's why I can't emphasize that enough. Lucid dreaming is a critical practice for all of these things.
Now, you know, you've brought up a lot of things that relate directly back to yoga as well. Things like withdrawing of the senses and, you know, turning off the outside world so that we can really, what I often call is digesting what we've consumed mentally. Because just as we know, if we eat too much food, we get either constipation or diarrhea in our gastrointestinal system. And the same thing goes for a constant bombardment of, you know, television, media, print, people, cultural situations, etc. If we don't stop and go inward and do a form of withdrawal from the outside stimulus, then we get what I like to call mental diarrhea or mental constipation, or rajas and tamas is how we call it in Ayurveda. And, you know, that brings me to the subject of ritual purification. You know, we have all of these forces outside of us and inside of us. And really, what is the goal of our spirituality? And a lot of times it is seen as you said in the Ritual Purification book, overcoming one's shortcomings, selfishness, and self-centeredness. But at the same time, it takes self-study, swadhyaya, not, you know, narcissism, but that self-centeredness is a form of not a negative aspect, but dedicating the time to go inward and study yourself and how are you being influenced and where are you sending your energy? Would you say that that is missed in some spiritual communities? Just, you know, how some teachings say, just follow this pathway, follow the teachings. But in what I've studied, it requires setting boundaries. It requires pulling away from the outside world and going inward for that purification.
You know, we have a certain environment which we're very fortunate to be in. And whether you accept the different numbers applied is irrelevant. Just as a general notion, it's good to work with this. You know, the notion of the Kali Yuga. That the idea being that everything you do takes effort, therefore it's worth more. You have to make choices. And we are very fortunate to have a great deal of opportunity to us in terms of wealth. And, you know, having worked in social services, I can say that, you know, it is, when we talk about poverty here, it's nothing compared to what is real poverty. I mean, there are some examples of it. I've dealt with it. Generally speaking, though, even poor people here, because it was my job to provide access, in theory, have potential access to far more than one could ever imagine. Unfortunately, that opportunities aren't used. And that was my job. I saw it. Okay. I set up a state-of-the-art computer learning resource center back in the day. HUD gave it awards. The people who used it weren't the people who needed it. It's karma. The family line, the inertia, was difficult to overcome. This is difficult for people to accept. They want to believe that if you just change every external circumstance, people will internally change. It doesn't work that way. We have to change external circumstances to give potential and opportunity, but it's not a direct cause and effect. Just as we are constantly bombarded and exposed to these media ideas, doesn't mean that we will automatically become something. It does lead us in that inclination, though. You know, it's, I think it was Wanamaker said, 50% of all my advertising dollars are wasted. I just wish I knew which half. Because it is a, you know, you throw enough against the wall phenomenon. But now we have targeting advertising. The media is such, particularly thanks to Google and Facebook and all of the great demiurgic forces that is called the internet, which is really just an externalization of Yesod in Kabbalah speak, which means the internet is an externalization of the unconscious forces. We can target advertising to people where they live in a cocoon. Even in a good cocoon, we see this with groups all the time with their media channels and their tweets and all this stuff where you can surround yourself with only those things that relate to what you want to hear and experience. That's not healthy. What we need to do is take time to disconnect from all of that and simply relax into the nature of our mind. But that's scary because as we relax, things come up. All of those energies of the day that were pushed down and have made us so heavy now suddenly have an opportunity to rise up. And people say, again, I don't like what I see or feel or think. Well, that's fine. Just then we have mindfulness training. We'll just let it go, let it go. It's not always that simple. Trauma is there. You know, how do you deal with that? But that means we need to also develop a healthy selfishness. You know, we talk about being selfless, and with that is a notion of almost an extreme martyrdom. a selflessness of walk all over me, crucify me. Oh, it doesn't matter what you do to me, all this kind of stuff. And that's not selfless. Maybe if you're an enlightened being of some kind and you can understand the consequences of your actions and what that will be in the long term for those people involved, that might be a different story. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about normal, everyday human beings who are trying to do the best on their path. And to do that, they need to have a period of time in which they separate from everything else so that they can collapse into the deepest part of themselves. And that's essential. And then from that, they're able to bring forth a host of potentialities and possibilities, even if ever so slowly, that we then call awakening, that we then call enlightenment, that gives true service, because that service is done with knowledge of karma, of cause and effect, not just out of habituated pattern or guilt or some notion of, I thought it was a good idea at the time.
Now, in your book, Ritual Purification, you talk about, you know, quite a few different avenues in which people can pursue this process of, you know, finding the highest potential, the highest powers within themselves, really isolating it. And, you know, meditation, I think, is universal in almost every practice. And you were discussing how when people sit down to meditate, A, they can't control their mind. B, they don't like what comes up, as you said. And so they stop. And I've often compared it to like lifting weights. You might want to lift a 300-pound weight, but if you don't practice 5 pounds and then 10 pounds and 20 pounds, you're not going to get to the 300-pound weight. And from your unique perspective and your amassing of different lineages, where would you recommend, because I can recommend people to meditate, but I think that I've said that enough times. Yeah. I would like for people to hear your recommendation on where to start in the process of purification through meditation.
Well, the best thing is, I mean, you have to follow the fundamentals. The fundamentals are posture and breathing and dedication. You know, even if it's just 5 minutes a time, and 5 minutes is better. One of the notions we have is these false notions of heroic practices. You know, I'm going to sit here for hours and it's worthless. 5 minutes a day, good. Well done in the morning. 5 minutes in the afternoon, well done. 3 minutes. You know, this kind of placing it across the day. You can get 20, 30 good minutes in a day if you break your day up. But that takes discipline because you don't get to do it and forget about it. Oh, I've checked that off the box, I walk away. No, okay, this is the time, it's noon. I'm gonna relax, I'm gonna do this for 5 minutes and then I'm gonna have lunch. Okay, it's the end of the day, it's 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, right at that liminal hour, you know, sun is going down or coming up in the morning, I'm gonna do this for 5 minutes. That takes effort. And that will get you far further than sitting down and trying to do something heroic. That cannot be stressed enough. And if you can't meditate as we think of, most people don't meditate. Very few people actually meditate. Very few people are involved in meditative absorption. What they're doing is contemplation. They're thinking about something or they're visualizing something. But rarely are they actually meditatively absorbed in it. So don't beat yourself up over that. Then just do breathing. If you just sit there and do slow, regular breathing, doesn't have to be some fancy pranayama, but just slow, regular breathing. That will help you because that will calm the mind. And there you've done something. Now, say you can't even do that. You have trouble with that. Then simply talk to yourself. You're doing it anyhow. You're always talking to yourself. Just admit to it and finally say something nice to yourself. Say, okay, now self, right now we're going to sit here and relax. We're going to breathe deep. Okay. Is everyone on board? Self. All right, because we know we have the five aspects of consciousness. You speak to them. Open up a good inner dialogue with yourself. amazing how that is underrated, but that is probably the most fundamental practice that will get you into actually getting verbal responses. You know, we talk about knowledge and conversation with our holy guardian angel, but if you actually want to hear responses from your unconscious and hear the what we call the music of the spheres, this is one of the things that will really open that up for you fairly quickly in order to have that experience and improve your dream life too. So just dialogue positively with yourself. That's all. Now, that's all you have to do, and it will progress on its own. In terms of purification, simply start with changing your thought, your word, and your deed on a daily basis. If you're about to say something critical or negative, stop. If you're about to look at some clickbait on the computer, stop. If you're about to do something, even if you want to do it, but you can feel yourself doing it out of habit, stop and put it off for 10 minutes. Breaking the habits is what brings awareness. So this is really very simple. It's just not easy, because we're building awareness. And then later on, as we talk about building awareness, what we're doing is we're building a stability of awareness so that we can exist within our unconscious, independent of physical supports. That's what we call immortality. That's what we call the rainbow body, the body of light, those things, where you have that meditative absorption where you do not rely on a physical body for stability of awareness.
Oh, I just love how you've outlined that, you know, because a lot of people are looking for the sensational, the fancy, the new, the trendy, the well-marketed or the flashy technique. And really what you said, it really does come down to those fundamental basics. You know, I have patients at the hospital who are, you know, dependent and or addictive on pain medications. And I'll tell them, look, if you could just do this breathing for 2-3 minutes before each dose, and then reevaluate your pain legitimately, or, you know, your anxiety medication, or, you know, your different things that they're doing and trying to become their best potential. It boils down to just those small increments of time spread through the day, as you said, to become a habit.
I think what we have is, again, this is a media thing, and it's fine. It's inspirational. I mean, the spiritual traditions are also part of the problem here, because they're filled with these heroic examples. And, you know, these heroic examples inspire us, but they can also distract us. They can become a bit of a dissuade us from practicing. Because if I can't practice like Milarepa, then why practice at all? Well, I don't know. Maybe Milarepa was an annoying nudge. Maybe I don't want to practice like him. Maybe he's overrated. You know, maybe it's all a sales pitch. You know, I've known quite a few people, some of them marginally famous, most of them not, who are extremely well-developed, extremely psychic. And not just in the sense of what we would think of as intuition or clairvoyance, but even in the domain of psychokinesis, which is a rare talent. You know, as I think Vivekananda said, you know, getting enlightenment in the mind is easy. Getting enlightenment in the body, which you think of as the tantric practices, that's another story altogether. And psychokinesis is kind of that psychic force in the world. That's a different level of operating, like alchemy in that regard. And they would all have told you the same thing I just told you right now. That's why I told you, because that's what they told me. That's what I did. That's what I still do. So I tell everyone, because you build on that. And then you're able to do, through effort, you're able to do more heroic things when needed.
Thank you for that. The last thing that I wanted to touch on that I had in my notes, and you made some references to it in some of your writings that I've read, and other authors really place a lot of emphasis on it as well, is a guru lineage, an undiluted, direct Guru Parampara. And, you know, for some people, that's maybe not practical for them, but for some people, it is a lifelong mission to truly find somebody who will give you undiluted lineage education. And how much more valuable or how much faster that can cause self-actualization or creating your highest potential and power.
Well, having had a lot of experience, and I can tell you it doesn't make a difference whatsoever. And I say that only because it's up to you as a student. I've watched people sit at the feet of tremendous people and they were still nudges. It just made them worse nudges. As soon as, you know, let's be, money doesn't make you, I'll try not to be vulgar here. It doesn't make you a buffoon. It just makes you a bigger one. It allows you to become a bigger one. And we've saw that in spiritual circles all the time, where it just, boom, I'm the Lama now. I've been approved by so-and-so. What happened is you're the one who showed up. You're the one who dedicated your life to it. And you're the one who's here. Whereas other people were out there, I don't know, getting a PhD or making art or doing another job. So let's be very honest here about what goes on in these spiritual groups. And a lot of it is nonsense. And these teachers have to put up with people who they'd rather really not be dealing with. But they're all they've got. Now, that's the reality. And that's across the board. Now, when you get a good teacher, all those people, you ignore them. You find out who they are and you ignore them. And you focus just on what the teacher is telling you when they're telling you, because you don't have to have a lifetime of relationship with that person. You just need to get what you need to get, absorb it, digest it, and apply it. You see that in the story of the Mahasiddhas. Some of the great Mahasiddhas, they just met a teacher once for 3 minutes and boom, they practiced everything they were taught and their life was changed. They become a Mahasiddha. Other people, they have a relationship for 3 years or 30 years. So this idea that I have to have that lineage, I have to have this lifelong relationship, it doesn't matter if the relationship isn't in your heart, or your heart mind. That's why when you think of the great teachers that you've had, regardless of who they are, that's an automatic remembering. Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. That's a meditative practice. That was what we would call a tantric practice. That's a guru yoga. Do this in remembrance of me. When the Eucharist is taking place and the Mass is taking place, the liturgy, that's a recreation of that historical moment in the present, because you're remembering it. So now it's now. Now it's not then, it's now. Same thing when you visualize or remember the teachers who've helped you, they can be long dead, but it brings up that experience and potentiality. And it can be any teacher. It doesn't have to be someone who necessarily has saffron robes or some appointment or some recognized authority. It's those people who've helped you. And you're gonna have more than one. This idea that you're gonna have one Yoda, who's gonna be your everything. This is toxic. This is a notion of what I call one of the toxic sides of monotheism, where one is everything. You're going to have many teachers who are going to help you in many different ways, because they're going to have different skill sets. And at some point you may meet some person who is an adept in all those areas, but until you have something to bring to the table, one, you're never going to meet them. Because they don't have time for you. That's the other thing. You've got to bring something to the table here, not just come with hat in hand begging to have your life fixed. Mm-hmm. It's different degrees of relationship. I wrote an essay, when where have all the masters gone, or when adepts walk away, on my blog, Vox Hermes, and it was because of a conversation like this where someone came up to me and said, where are all these adepts? I said, what do they have anything to do with you? All you're concerned about is yourself. You're just looking for new excitement. They don't want anything to do with you. Go away. And you see that in the literature where the yogis aren't necessarily nice. The lamas aren't necessarily nice. They throw rocks at people and say, get out of here. Leave me alone. So we have to really be realistic in what our expectations are from these people and realistic in what we're bringing and to this equation. Because this is where, to use the Masonic analogy, you know, this is rubbing the ashlar, getting the rough sides off the ashlar and making the stone smooth so that it can fit into the temple. You know, you're coming with all this pathology and expecting everything to be done for you. Or, yeah, I'll do a little bit of that. You know what I mean? People say, I'll do anything. I said, don't lie to me. You won't do anything. As soon as you said that, you told me you're a liar. What are you really willing to do? And then let's start there. So, yeah, this notion of the lineage is only as good as the student, not the teacher. That's the other side of it. So if you are dedicated, if you have a wonderful book that really inspires you, you've got a teacher who you've never met, but maybe have some YouTube videos that really inspire you and you really focus on that practice. When you do that, you'll get far enough where the next step will unfold for you.
Beautiful.
Particularly if you focus on lucid dreaming, to have that inner awakening on the inside.
Well, where would you recommend people learn about lucid dreaming if they're not familiar with it?
Oh, from my book, Between the Gates.
Excellent. Excellent.
Well, we have videos too. You can only listen to videos online, but it's critical.
So for people who are new to you, where else can they access information about you? Because I know you have a lot out there. Yeah, how many books do you have out?
I don't know. We're around 30 at some point.
Yeah.
There's some in the pipeline, so it just gets lost in translation.
And your website?
Website is, it's tricky now. We're trying to merge platforms. There's the website, which is the Institute for Hermetic Studies, and that will take you to our blog, Vox Hermes, but you can just type that in, Vox Hermes, and our blog will come up, and we're trying to get all these merged. And then there's our programs on Teachable. So Institute for Hermetic Studies, and you go to teachable.com, plug that in, and you'll see a course, our course offerings, and there, everything is there.
And people can also find discussions that you've had on YouTube, yes?
Oh,
a lot.
You know, I was surprised. Yeah, I really was. This topic is, and just so you know, we are very fortunate in this interview to focus on things unique to your audience. Very often when I do this interview, it tends to be the same because it's the same questions, but just the way it goes. So there are other interviews out there. I think at Glitch Bottle, a host of them out there on egregores that they should listen to because they'll find that they go in a very different direction than we have here. But there's probably, I don't know, 30, 40 videos out there with me on it.
And you also have a Patreon, correct?
Yes, we do. For those who want to support us, we have a Patreon page. And the beautiful thing about that is we send you stuff, and we send you stuff monthly, regularly. So, you know, we thank you and we send you good stuff. What we have there, which is fun, is I put together mini courses. So we'll send you once a month at whatever the level is there, I'd have to look. We'll send you several links to videos on a particular topic. And then we'll send you also PDFs, documentation on that topic. And the idea there is people don't just want to hear me speak. They want to hear other people too. There's other well-known authorities and experts out there. And just people with good experiences who, when we put this together, it's just as you would have in university. When you went to get your degree, you had a teacher and that teacher had books and those books weren't all written by him or her. I mean, there was a lot of information being poured into that class for you to become knowledgeable in that subject matter and then move on and have access to further your exploration if you wanted to. So that's what we've done there. Then we have our newsletter. Our newsletter for that newsletter, that annual, is really spectacular. It's a lot of fun. And then we have more serious videos too, lengthy ones, and some discussions on text. So there's a lot there for people to explore.
Excellent. Because I want listeners to be able to really find the information and dive deep into the information. You know, this is just an introduction for people who have not heard of some of these concepts. And I really thank you for coming on today and spending your time, your prana, your energy into being available for different listeners and maybe a different slice of the population so that they too can further their journey and be their best they can possibly be.
Thank you very much. It was great being here.
Thank you, Mr. Mark Stavish. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
You as well.
And also in the video link I'll be posting on Healthier Vibrations, I'll be sure to include links back to your webpage so that people can access the different references that we've discussed as well.
Yeah, do the webpage and Teachable. Okay. I think those are the best. I mean, it's nice for them to go to Patreon, but the first thing they're going to get hit there is really, you know, it's Patreon, you know, so we're hitting them for money. It's better for them to see the classes first and then move from there to see if they want to get involved in those classes, because then there's some space. They can step into it at their own leisure.
Excellent. I'll be sure to include links so that people can learn more and dig deeper into this process.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stavish. Have a beautiful day.
Bye-bye.
Take care.